Chapter 5. The Incident at Griboyedov. The antique, two-storey, cream-coloured mansion was situated on the boulevard ring in the depths of a sickly garden, separated from the path by an ornate cast-iron fence. There was a small asphalted courtyard in front of the house. In the wintertime, it housed a large pile of snow with a shovel, but in the summertime, it turned into a most magnificent seating section of a summer restaurant beneath a canvas tent. The mansion was known as Griboyedov House, on the grounds that it allegedly was once owned by the aunt of the writer, Alexander Sergeyevich Griboyedov. Actually, we do not know for sure whether she owned it or not. Come to think of it, Griboyedov never had any home-owning aunts. But anyway, that's what the place was called. Moreover, some Muscovite liar once said that it was on the second floor, in the round room with the columns, that the famous writer read excerpts of Woe from Wit to the selfsame aunt as she lounged on a sofa. Then again, hell knows, maybe it did happen. It doesn't really matter. What matters is that at the present time, the house was owned by the very Masolit that, prior to his appearance at Patriarch's Ponds, was chaired by the unfortunate Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz. Thanks to the ever-casual members of Masolit, no one called the mansion Griboyedov House. Instead, everyone simply said Griboyedov. I spent 2 hours knocking around at Griboyedov yesterday. Well, wheedled myself a month's vacation in Yalta. Good man. Or perhaps, go and see Berlioz. He'll be available from 4 to 5 in Griboyedov. And so on. Masolit established itself in Griboyedov in the cosiest of fashions. Anyone entering Griboyedov would first involuntarily become acquainted with notices posted by various sports clubs, as well as individual and group photographs of Masolit members hanging, the photos, that is, on the walls of the staircase leading to the second floor. The very first room on this upper floor had a large sign on its doors that read, Angling Cottage Section. And right next to it was a picture of a carp snagged on a line. Something slightly less clear was written on door number 2. One day, creative trips, apply with M.V. Podlojnaya. The next door bore a short but utterly incomprehensible sign, Pereligina. Thereafter, the chance visitor to Griboyedov would be overwhelmed by numerous inscriptions scattered over the aunt's walnut doors. Paper queue, C. Pokliovkina. Cashier, sketch writer's personal accounts. Cutting through the longest queue that started far below in the foyer, one could see the inscription on a door that faced a fresh onslaught of people every second. Housing question. The housing question was followed by a magnificent poster depicting a cloaked horseman riding along the crest of a cliff with a rifle slung over his shoulder. Below him, a young man with a forelock, sitting on a balcony surrounded by palm trees, staring off into the distance with ever so lively eyes and holding a fountain pen. Inscription. All-inclusive, writing holidays from 2 weeks, short story, novella, to 1 year, novel, trilogy. Yalta, Suksu, Borovia, Siksidziri, Mahinjauri, Leningrad, Winter Palace. This door also had a queue, but not as excessive. A mere 150 people or so. Then, following the whimsical curves, lifts and dips of Griboyedov House, came Masolit Board. Cashiers numbers 2, 3, 4, 5. Editorial Board. Masolit Chairman. Billiard Room. Various secondary offices. And finally, the very room with the columns where the aunt enjoyed her brilliant nephew's comedy. Any visitor to Griboyedov, unless of course he was a complete dunce, would immediately realise just how well-off and fortunate the members of Masolit were, and the blackest of envies would instantly begin to consume him, and he would bitterly reproach the heavens for not endowing him with literary talent, without which, naturally, one could not even dream of owning a Masolit membership pass. Brown, smelling of expensive leather, with a broad golden border, it was a pass known to all of Moscow. Who would dare say a word in defence of envy? It is an emotion of the wicked kind, But we must also put ourselves in the visitor's shoes. For what he saw on the second floor was not all, and far from it. The entire bottom floor of the aunt's house was occupied by a restaurant, and what a restaurant it was! It was justly considered the best in Moscow. And not just because it took up two vast halls with vaulted ceilings, painted with lilac horses with Assyrian manes, not just because every table had a shaded lamp, not just because any regular man off the street could not dine there, but also because the quality of food at Griboyedov beat any other restaurant in Moscow hands down, and because this food was delivered at a very moderate, none too taxing price. Thus, there is nothing surprising in the following conversation, once overheard by the author of these most truthful words by Griboyedov's cast-iron fence.
"Where are you dining tonight, Anfrosi?"
"Do you have to ask? Here, of course, my dear Foka. Archibald Archibaldovich whispered to me today that they have perch au naturel à la carte. Divine little thing!"
"You certainly know how to live it up, Anfrosi,"
sighed Foka, a skinny, neglected man with a carbuncle on his neck, at the giant, lush-lipped, golden-haired, plump-cheeked Anfrosi the poet. "I know nothing out of the ordinary," objected Anfrosi. "I only have the perfectly natural desire to live like a human being. You all tell me, Foka, that you can find perch at the Colosseum as well. But at the Colosseum, a portion of perch costs 13.15, whereas here it's 5.50. Furthermore, the perch at the Colosseum is 3 days old. And finally, over there you'll have absolutely no guarantee you won't get your muzzle whipped with a bunch of grapes by the first young man to burst in from Theatre Drive. No, I categorically oppose the Colosseum," thundered the gastronome Anfrosi for the entire boulevard to hear. "Don't you try to convince me, Foka."
"I'm not trying to convince you, Anfrosi," squealed Foka, "but one can dine at home."
"Thank you humbly," Anfrosi trumpeted. "I can imagine your wife struggling with her tiny pot in the communal kitchen at home, trying to construct perch au naturel à la carte. Au revoir, Foka." And singing, Anfrosi headed for the tent-covered veranda.
Yes, those were the days. Moscow's old-timers remember the famous Griboyedov. What are poached perch à la carte? Cheap trifles, my dear Anfrosi. What about sturgeon? Sturgeon in a silver pot, pieces of sturgeon interlaid with lobster tails and fresh caviar, and the eggs en cocotte, with mushroom puree served in little cups. Or perhaps you didn't like the thrush fillets, with truffles. Quails à la genoise, 10.50. And the jazz, and the courteous service. In July, when the whole family's off in the country, while urgent literary business keeps you in town, how about a bowl of soupe printanière, placed in the golden circle, on a pristine tablecloth, on a veranda in the shade of the grapevines? Remember, Anfrosi? I don't even need to ask. I can tell by your lips you do. What are your white fish and your perch? What about the snipe, the jacksnipe, the great snipe, the woodcock when in season, the quail, the sandpiper, the fizz of mineral water in your mouth? But enough. You grow distracted, reader. Follow me. At 10:30 on the evening, when Berlioz died on the Patriarchs, only one room was lit on Griboyedov's top floor, where 12 writers who had gathered for the meeting were languishing as they waited for Mikhail Alexandrovich. Sitting on chairs, tables, and even on two of the windowsills in the massolit boardroom, those present were suffering badly on account of the hot spell. Not a single breath of fresh air entered the open windows. Moscow was releasing the heat accumulated by day in the asphalt, and it was clear that night would bring no relief. The smell of onions floated up from the restaurant kitchen in the basement of the aunt's house. Everyone was thirsty, everyone was wound up, and everyone was angry. The novelist, Peskudnikov, a quiet, decently dressed man with attentive yet elusive eyes, took out his watch. The hands crept on to 11.
Bezkudnikov tapped his finger on the dial and showed it to the neighbouring poet, Dvoubratsky, who was sitting on a table and dangling his rubber-soled yellow shoes in boredom. "Really now," grumbled Dvoubratsky.
"Lad must have gotten stuck on the chiasma,"
came the thick voice of Natasya Lukinishna Nepremyonova. Orphaned daughter of a Moscow merchant, she became a writer and now composed naval battle tales under the pen name Skipper George.
"Excuse me,"
the popular sketch writer Zagrivov began boldly.
"Right now, I'd much rather be sipping some tea on the balcony instead of boiling in here. The meeting was scheduled for 10, wasn't it?"
"Very nice right now on the chiasma,"
Skipper George egged on, knowing that the writer's cottage colony of Pereligina on the Chiasma River was a sore point for everyone.
"Nightingales must be out singing by now. I always find it easier to work in the country, especially in springtime."
"It's the third year now that I'm making payments to send my sick wife to that heaven, but somehow nothing ever floats my way," said the novelist Jeronim Poprykin with bitter venom.
"Some get lucky, some don't,"
droned the critic Ababkov from the windowsill. Skipper George's beady eyes lit up with delight as she gloated, softening her contralto voice.
"Let's not get jealous, folks. There are only 22 cottages, and they're only building 7 more, whereas there are 3,000 of us here in Masulit."
3,111,
someone put in from the corner.
"You see,"
continued the skipper,
"what can we do? Naturally, the more talented of us receive the cottages."
"Yeah, the generals,"
cut in Gluharyov, the scenarist joining the squabble. Yawning artificially, Bezkudnikov left the room.
5 rooms in Pereligina for 1 man," Gluharyov called after him.
"Lavrovitch has 6, cried Deniskin, "and an oak-panelled dining room."
"Bah, right now that's not the problem,"
droned Ababkov.
"The problem is that it's 11:30.
A din arose, and a rebellion of sorts was brewing. They started to call the loathsome Pereligina, got the wrong number, Lavrovitch's, and discovered that Lavrovitch had left for the river, which made them even more upset. They randomly called the Commission of Fine Literature at extension number 930, and, of course, found no one there.
"He could have called," shouted Deniskin, Gluharyov, and Quant.
Alas, their cries were in vain. Mikhail Alexandrovich could no longer call anybody. Far, far away from Griboyedov, in a giant room lit by 1,000-watt bulbs, there lay on 3 zinc tables what had so recently been Mikhail Alexandrovich. On the first, a naked body caked in dry blood, with a broken arm and crushed ribcage. On the second, a head with missing front teeth and cloudy, wide-open eyes that no longer feared the blinding light. On the last, a pile of crusty rags. By the beheaded corpse stood a professor of forensic medicine, a pathological anatomist and his dissector, representatives of the investigation, and Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz's assistant director, the writer Zildibin, summoned by telephone from a sick wife's bedside. The car picked up Zeldybin and first took him and the investigators to the victim's apartment to seal his papers. This was around midnight. Only then did they all head to the morgue. Those standing by the remains of the deceased were now conferring on whether it was best to sew the severed head to the stump of the neck or simply to wrap the body tightly to the chin in black cloth and thus lay it out in the Griboyedov hall. Yes, Mikhail Alexandrovich could not call anybody, and all the protesting and shouting done by Deniskin, Gluharyov, Quant, and Bezkudnikov was completely pointless. Exactly at midnight, all 12 writers left the top floor and descended to the restaurant. Here, they again silently cursed Mikhail Alexandrovich. Naturally, all the tables on the veranda had already been taken, and they would have to eat in the pretty but stuffy inner halls. And exactly at midnight, something boomed, rang, spilled, and jumped in the first of these halls. Immediately, a high-pitched male voice screamed desperately to the music, "Hallelujah!" The famous Griboyedov jazz band had struck up. The sweaty faces seemed to glow. The painted horses on the ceiling seemed to come alive. The lamps seemed to spill more light. And suddenly, both halls burst into dance, as if unleashed along with the veranda. Gluharyov danced off with the poetess Tamara Half Moon. Quant danced. The novelist Zhukopov danced with some film star in a yellow dress. Dragunsky danced. Cherdakchi danced. The tiny Deniskin danced with the gigantic Skipper George. The gorgeous architect Shmegenagul danced, gripped firmly by some stranger in white canvas pants. The locals and the guests danced, the Muscovites and the visitors, the writer Johann from Kronstadt, some guy named Vitaly Kowoftik, with a purple blemish all over his cheek, apparently a stage director from Rostov. The leading representatives of Masolit's poetry sub-department danced, namely Pavianov, Bogohulsky, Sladsky, Spichkin, and Adelfina Bowodziak. Several young men of unknown occupation danced, sporting crew cuts and shoulder pads. Some very old man with a piece of onion stuck in his beard danced, and with him a sickly anemic elderly girl in a wrinkled dress of orange silk. Sweating profusely, waiters carried frosty beer steins over people's heads, shouting hoarsely and hatefully, "Pardon me, sir!" Somewhere a voice commanded through a loudspeaker, "One kaski shish kebab, two zubrovkas, homestyle tripe!" The high-pitched voice no longer sang but howled, "Hallelujah!" Slamming cymbals rose occasionally over the deafening clatter of dishes lowered by dishwashers into the kitchen via an incline. In short, pure hell. And, come midnight, hell produced a vision. A handsome, dark-eyed man, in a tailcoat, with a dagger-like beard, came onto the veranda and cast a regal gaze over his domain. Mystics speak of a time when it was not a tailcoat the man wore, but a broad leather belt with pistol butts sticking out. When crimson silk was tied round his raven-black hair, and when there sailed on the Caribbean seas a brig under his command, bearing a deadly black flag with skull and crossbones. But no, no, the mystic enchanters lie, for there are no Caribbean seas in the world. No hot-headed buccaneers to sail upon them, no corvettes to give chase, no cannon smoke to drift over the waves. There isn't any of that, nor has there ever been. The sickly linden over there, that exists, and the cast-iron gate, and beyond it the boulevard, and the ice melts in the bowl, and someone's bloodshot, bovine eyes glare from the neighbouring table, and it is all so horrible. Horrible! Oh, gods, ye gods of mine, give me poison. Poison. Suddenly, a name came up at one of the tables.
Berlioz!
The jazz fell apart and fell silent, as if struck by a fist.
What? Berlioz!
And up they went, clamouring. Yes. A wave of grief rose at the terrible news about Mikhail Alexandrovich. Someone very agitated insisted that everyone must immediately, right here, right now, without moving an inch, compose some sort of collective telegram and send it off at once. But what sort of telegram, we ask? And where to? And why send it? And again, where? And how could a telegram be of any use to him whose crushed nape is even now being squeezed by the dissector's rubbery hands, whose neck is even now being stabbed by the professor's crooked needles? He is dead, and he doesn't need any telegrams. It is all over. Let us burden the telegraph no more. Yes, he is dead, quite dead. But we are still alive. True, there rose a wave of grief and held a while, but then it began to recede. A few here and there returned to their tables and, covertly at first and then quite openly, had a sip of vodka and a bite to eat. After all, why waste the chicken cutlets du volai? How will that help Mikhail Alexandrovich? By keeping us hungry? We are still alive, after all! Now, The piano was locked up, of course, the band dismissed, and several journalists left for their offices to compose obituaries. Word was out that Zeldybin had returned from the morgue. He situated himself in the deceased man's office upstairs, which immediately started a rumour that he would be the one to succeed Berlioz. Zeldybin summoned all 12 members of the management board from the restaurant, and the urgent meeting in Berlioz's office began with a discussion of pressing questions on decorating the colonnaded Griboyedov Hall, on transporting the body from the morgue to this hall, on access to the body, and on other issues relating to the heartbreaking event. Meanwhile, the restaurant returned to nightly business as usual. It would have carried on thus till closing time, or 4 o'clock in the morning, had there not transpired something completely bizarre, something that shocked the patrons far more than the news of Berlioz's death. The first to notice were the cabbies waiting outside Griboyedov's gates. Rising in his seat, one of them could be heard shouting, "Whoa, just look at that!" Then out of nowhere, a tiny light flickered into existence by the cast-iron fence and began to approach the veranda. Rising at their tables and peering into the distance, the patrons witnessed a white apparition marching on the restaurant along with the light. As it approached the trellis, everybody froze with eyes wide open and pieces of sturgeon still on their forks. The doorman, who had stepped outside from the cloakroom for a smoke, stamped out his cigarette and made to block the apparition from entering the restaurant. But for some reason, he failed to follow through and stopped, grinning stupidly. Passing through the trellis, the unhindered apparition stepped onto the veranda. Everyone now saw that it was not an apparition at all, but the famous poet, Ivan Nikolaevich Homeless. He was barefoot, in striped white long johns, and a faded paper icon of some unknown saint was affixed by a safety pin to his torn white shirt. In his hand, Ivan Nikolaevich was carrying a lit church candle. His right cheek was freshly bruised. It would have been difficult to measure the depth of the silence that fell on the veranda. Beer poured from a tilted stein in the hands of a waiter. The poet raised the candle above his head and said loudly, "Greetings, friends!" He then looked under the nearest table and exclaimed miserably, "No, he's not there." Two voices came. A merciless bass said, "Done deal, delirium tremens." A second frightened female voice spoke, "How did the police let him walk around in that outfit?" Ivan Nikolaevich heard the second comment and explained, "Tried to stop me twice, once on Skotertny and once here on Bronnaya, except I jumped a fence and scratched my cheek." Here Ivan Nikolaevich raised his candle and cried out, "Brothers in literature!" His hoarse voice grew stronger and more passionate. "Hear me all, for he has come. Catch him immediately, or he will cause untold trouble." "What? What? What did he say? Who has come?" came voices from every direction. "The consultant," Ivan replied. "And this consultant has just murdered Misha Berlioz on the Patriarchs." At this, everyone poured out from the inner halls onto the veranda, forming a crowd round Ivan's flame.
Excuse me, could you explain that?" A quiet, polite voice spoke into Ivan's ear. "Could you tell us who murdered him? Who?"
"A foreign consultant, a professor and a spy," Ivan replied, gazing round.
"What's his name?"
the voice in his ear asked softly.
"That's the thing, the name," Ivan cried miserably. "If only I knew the name. I couldn't make it out on the business card. I just remembered the W, the name. It starts with a W. What was that name with a W?
Ivan asked himself, grasping his forehead and muttering,
Vashner Wagner,
Weiner, Weiner, Wegner, Wegner, Winter.
The hair on Ivan's head began to crawl with strain.
Wolf!
Some woman cried piteously. Ivan grew angry.
Idiot!
He cried, searching out the speaker with his eyes.
What's Wolf got to do with it? Wolf didn't do anything. Vau! Vau!
No! I just can't remember like this.
Listen, folks, call the police at once. Tell them to send 5 motorcycles equipped with machine guns to catch the professor. Oh, and don't forget to mention there are 2 others with him. Some tall, checkered guy, cracked pince-nez, and this fat black cat. In the meantime, I'll search Griboyedov. I can sense it. He's here.
Ivan grew anxious, pushed aside the onlookers, and began to wave his candle around, looking under the tables and spilling wax on himself. Then someone said, "We need a doctor." And a gentle, plump, fleshy, clean-shaven face in horn-rimmed glasses appeared before Ivan.
"Comrade homeless," the face began in a podium voice, "please calm down. You're upset by the death of everyone's beloved Mikhail Alexandrovich. No, let me simply say, Misha Berlioz. We understand perfectly. You need rest. Your friends will see you to bed, and you'll forget."
"Listen,"
Ivan interrupted, baring his teeth.
"We need to catch the professor. Don't you get it? And instead you go pestering me with this nonsense, you cretin."
"Comrade homeless, I beg your pardon," said the face, reddening and retreating, already regretting it ever got involved in this mess.
"No," said Ivan Nikolaevich with quiet hatred. "You, of all people, I have no intention to pardon."
A spasm distorted his face as he quickly transferred the candle from right hand to left, took a broad swing, and hit the sympathetic face on the ear. At this point, the onlookers had the presence of mind to throw themselves at Ivan, and throw themselves they did. The candle blew out, and the glasses that had popped off the face were instantly crushed. Ivan let out a fierce battle cry, heard to everyone's delight as far as the boulevard, and began to defend himself. Dishes clattered as they fell from tables, and women began to scream. While the waiters were tying up the poet with some napkins, the brig commander addressed the doorman in the cloakroom.
"Did you see the Long Johns?" the pirate asked coldly.
"Yes, Archibald Archiboldovich," the doorman answered timidly. "But how could I not let the gentleman by if he's a Massolit member?"
"Did you see the Long Johns?" repeated the pirate.
"Forgive me, Archibald Archiboldovich," said the doorman, turning purple. "What could I do? I understand there are ladies on the veranda and all."
"The ladies have nothing to do with it. They don't care," answered the pirate, literally burning up the doorman with his eyes. "The police care. A man in underwear can walk the streets of Moscow in but one case. If he is being escorted by the police, and for but one destination, a police station. And as a doorman, you ought to know that if you see such a man, you must immediately sound your whistle. Can you hear?"
Scared out of his wits, the doorman heard battle yelps, the sound of dishes shattering, and women's cries from the veranda.
"What am I to do with you?" asked the buccaneer.
The doorman's skin took on a typhoid hue, and life drained from his eyes. He imagined the presently combed and parted black hair covered with fiery silk. The shirt and tailcoat vanished, and instead a pistol handle jutted out from a leather belt. The doorman pictured himself strung up on the foretop yardarm. His eyes saw his own tongue dangling from his own lifeless, drooping head, and he even heard the splashing of waves overboard. The doorman's knees buckled. But then the buccaneer took pity on him and extinguished his glare.
"Watch it, Nikolai. This is the last time. We wouldn't need doormen like you in this restaurant if they came free of charge. You'd be better suited to working in a church."
Having said this, the commander gave precise, quick and clear orders.
"Get Pantelei from the bar, police, protocol, transportation to the mental clinic."
And he added,
"Blow your whistle."
In a quarter of an hour, amazed onlookers had gathered not only in the restaurant, but also on the boulevard and in house windows facing the garden. Watching Pantelei, the doorman, a policeman, a waiter, and the poet Ruekin, as they left Griboyedov's gates, carrying a young man who was swaddled like a mummy and weeping uncontrollably. Choking on his tears, the young man kept spitting, trying especially hard to hit Ruekin, and screaming,
"Bastard!"
The mean-faced truck driver started his engine. A cabbie was warming up his horse nearby, thrashing it with violent rein, shouting,
"Try this racer! I've driven to the clinic before!"
The crowd buzzed all around, discussing the extraordinary occurrence. In other words, it was a filthy, repugnant, swinish, tempting scandal, which ended only when the truck left Griboyedov's gates, carrying the unfortunate Ivan Nikolaevich, the policeman, Pantelei, and Ruekin.